from the succulent studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it's time for another invasive hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Have you come across bright red berries growing on thickets in the woods or even right next to your mailbox? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll discuss one of my absolute favorite wild foods, the wonderful wineberry. Plus, a heap and helping of your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and satisfyingly succinct salutations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you looking for what might become your favorite fruit.
WDIY has been broadcasting since 1995.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
We're with Commissioner Frank Donches of the Bethlehem Police Department.
We welcome Dr. John of the Blend today.
Bob Durow composed, conducted, and played much of the Schoolhouse Rock music.
Three is a magic number.
Stepping the antidote to violence is to speak up against it.
WDIY for 30 years.
From the glowing studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another luminescent hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we recount a wonderful story first reported by Lee Ann Henowin in a recent edition of the National Geographic. And we quote, hundreds of people have gathered on a dark mountain in Appalachia. Fireflies drift overhead, but the real spectacle is closer to the ground. An embankment where, nestled in damp moss, glowworms shined like pinpricks of neon blue. People always exclaim, they're so bright. What they are is the larval form of a fungus gnat. And they produce the bluest bioluminescence of any known insect on Earth. Their glow can rival that of fireflies. But while fireflies are familiar summer icons, these blue glowworms often go unnoticed. In fact, many populations have been discovered by accident. This includes the one at North Carolina's Grandfather Mountain, which may be one of the densest populations in the world. Most visitors come searching for synchronous fireflies during their peak season from May to June, but many leave talking about the glowworms, tiny translucent creatures that transform forest floors and stream banks into rivers of electric blue. The species was first described to science by B.B. Fulton, an entomologist who found glowworms in his western North Carolina yard and published his findings in 1941. Gary Mullen, an entomologist who spent 30 years studying the glowworms, explains that they're quite widespread in the mountains, but people don't tend to walk around in the dark without flashlights, so they don't notice them. Even trained naturalists have mistaken the species for something else. Until 2014, rangers at Anna Ruby Falls Recreation Area in Georgia assumed that the mysterious springtime lights came from female blue ghost fireflies, another elusive glowing insect. Only when a visiting scientist formally identified them as fungus gnat larvae did they realize what they had. A few repeat visitors have told Anna Falls employee Tracy Allen that since learning how to identify them on those night hikes, they've noticed small populations in their own neighborhoods. Quote, people are used to the idea of fireflies, but glowworms are like nothing they've seen before, says Allen. They kind of remind me of stars, only they're on the ground, We could hold tours every night and still sell out. Even as scientists begin to understand how the creatures produce their vibrant blue glow, much about them remains a mystery. What's clear, however, is that glowworms thrive in darkness. Michael Hodge, a ranger at Pickett CCC Memorial Park in Jamestown, Tennessee, hosts monthly stargazing programs, and he's noticed a familiar reaction from visitors encountering either glowworms or the Milky Way for the first time. You hear gasps. You hear people cheering. They realize that there's nothing between them and the stars and the glowworms. Quote, "It's not on YouTube. It's real. And people react strongly," he notes, "when they experience a sudden awareness that there are still things out there for them to discover."
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit, I will tell you about a wonderful fruit you've probably seen all over the place, and you can enjoy it if you just open your eyes. But before that, another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Ronald, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike, for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Ronald. Where are you?
I'm located in Burlington County. That's Zone 6.
Right near the Burlington-Bristol Bridge, right?
That is correct. And also Fort McGuire, Fort Dix military base. We're literally 5 minutes away.
Okay. Well, if you need a tank, it'll get there in a hurry. What can we do you for?
We have these tiger lilies, and I believe I shared with you some photographs where we have these little pods. They almost look like large pepper, black pepper beads or raisins, which have attached themselves to the tiger lilies. And we started using some Felsnapter and a product called Dettol, which is a universal application for primarily medical purposes, cleaning, sanitation. And they now seem to be soft because they were hard, round balls which gathered at the top of the tiger lily. And now they seem to be falling off. I did cut one open, a number of them open, actually.
Good.
And they're soft inside, creamy, lime green, and that's about it. Just trying to keep them off the tiger lilies.
Well, you know, tiger lilies are wild daylilies. They're another one of these wonderful plants that's been called invasive. But I love them. They're on the road across from my house. And they bloom more reliably than cultivated daylilies. So I do remember your photographs, and we had a little bit of a back and forth, but as I told you, I tried to search this every which way, and I could find no reference. I couldn't find it listed as a daylily pest or problem. I tried to run it through insect identification and came up totally blank. So I'm going to talk to you more about what you found inside And you sent a beautiful picture of these things on your daylily stem. And yeah. I said they look like small black jelly beans.
Yep, that's another way of describing them.
Yeah, and, you know, quite frankly, they didn't look bad. If you didn't know better, you might think they were part of the plant. But now, before we get to that, I want to ask you a question. You say they're falling off now. Have they damaged the daylilies in any way?
No, not at all. In fact, when you mentioned the regularity of the tiger lily coming up, they're now, the tiger lilies are now 4 and 5 feet tall.
Huh.
They're huge, and they've got beautiful buds, orange, beautiful orange or volcano orange buds, which opened up. But the black raisins,
yeah,
pods, some of them are still there, but they have definitely, instead of having to rake them off, you can just literally tap it and they'll fall off.
So even if they're not at the top and ready to fall, all you got to do is touch it?
Yes, and I have to, only because of applying either the Felsnapter or the Dettol, which are, again, both biodegradable. That's the only reason why I can come to that they are falling off.
Well, I've heard of a lot of folk cures, but I've never heard Felsnapter being
okay.
used as, I'm presuming, we're looking at some kind of an insect, because if there's no scar on the plant, there's no interaction going on. They might be eggs. I would try to collect some and just put them in a screened box and see if anything comes out eventually, because I am darn curious about this. So they don't seem to be causing a problem. And as I said, they look, you know, highly ornamental to me.
We were concerned that they might also attack. We have Pyrenees in that same flower bed. We have tulips, the hyacinths, and I'm not sure, I didn't do a timeline, but they didn't really blossom very well this year.
Well,
so I'm not
you
sure.
and I I'm both sure. got a severe drought at the end of winter. I mean, 2 months of drought. And now we're being flooded every other day. A township right near me got 8 inches in an hour. The road outside was raging whitewater. It was one of the worst I've ever seen. So, you know, some of these plants are going to react to these stresses.
Yes.
I think I said on a previous show, if something goes wrong in your garden this year, I think you're not at fault. You know, it's climate, and the climate gets weirder and weirder all the time. And they're not on those other plants, right?
No, they're not. They're not gathering. I will, though, to your point earlier, I will take a closer look at those that we've already scraped off, or perhaps scrape some new ones, and see if there's any footprint, for want of a better term, between the little black raisins and the tiger lilies. I will take a closer look. I didn't look at it that closely when I did take them off.
You know, unless you get lucky, you're not going to find any reference to this, because I searched the heck out of it. Now, the ones you cut open, had they dropped or did you tap them off?
No, the ones I cut open initially, I had to kind of rake off. But since then, every week I've gone back, and as I mentioned, as I tap the tiger lily, a few will fall off.
Okay, so you may accidentally have succeeded in smothering them using the Felsnapter, because it's soap. And
you may
have created your own semi-natural insecticidal soap.
Okay.
So you know what to do. I really can't speak to it. I didn't even know they made Felsnapter anymore. My mother used to use that for the laundry when I was 10 years old.
I was about to say we're the old school people.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, we use the vinegar and all these, you know, pharma, you know, methods. But they're safe, they're clean, because we have our emotional support dogs. We have lots of other animals. So we have to be careful.
All right. Before I let you go, let's discuss a little bit about what you found inside. Was the inside filled with liquid? Was it mostly hollow?
It was a bit like an avocado, where when I cut the shell, which was a little crispy, it seemed to have a membrane.
Mm-hmm.
No liquid came out. I think some of the pictures I shared with you, I showed you that I had cut them open, but you couldn't necessarily see any kind of liquid forming on the tissue paper.
Okay.
Were
they solid inside?
No. It was mucous membrane, lime green on the outer side of the inside, and then yellow. And then I believe there was a hollow area.
Okay. The best I can come up with is that they are some sort of insect eggs, but not the eggs of a pest insect. I know they're probably not praying mantis eggs, but I'm thinking of something like that, like stick insects or stuff we don't normally think about. And, you know, the size would seem to be somewhat equal to what you'd expect a praying mantis egg to look like. So I'm going to double down. I really want you to take some of the healthiest ones. But just make a little screened box, just with window screening, and put it in a cool, dry place and check it every once in a while. And you may find things crawling around in there eventually.
I'll see if I can set up one of the little cameras we have with a
timer. Ah, there you go.
And see if we can catch.
We'll break the internet.
Yeah.
But cool. You intrigue me. This intrigues me. And I have a feeling we're not done. So stay in touch. And let me know if they do progress into anything. And remember, they're not hurting your plants and they look good.
There you go. Mike, I really appreciate this. And just to let you know, I've been listening to you for at least 20, 30 years when we were living up north in Essex County. And you've always shown us some great ideas, shared some great ideas.
Thank you. You've been there for all of it.
Horticulture is a passion. Thank you.
You can lead a horse to culture, but you can't make him drink. All right. Thank you, Ronald. This is an intriguing conversation, and I will ask anybody out there who has any idea what these things are to get in touch with me, because I need more clues.
To be continued.
Yes. All right. Well, good luck and stay in touch, sir.
Certainly will. Thank you.
My pleasure. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there to clearly mark the beds where you grew garlic this season and start thinking about which other beds you're going to be planting this season's garden cloves in to keep dreaded disease at bay. Rotation rules. But don't go perusing those garlic growing sites just yet, because we'll be right back to discuss the wonderful world of wineberries and take more of your wonderful phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610 694 8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and it's a mostly phone call show today, cats and kittens. But at the end of those calls, you better stay tuned because I'm going to tell you about your new favorite fruit. And it's free. Number to call, 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Kathy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike. I am blessed to be here. I feel like I'm with gardening royalty.
I don't know. I think I'd be the court jester. Yeah, really. Hey, it's a good job. Where are you, Kath?
I'm in Center County in Center Hall, Pennsylvania. We're close to Penn State.
I know where you are. What can I do you for?
Well, we moved in 10 years ago to a very tidy home on 3/4 of an acre where everything was treated and trimmed.
Ugh.
Everything is pom-pom shaped, cone shaped, lot of
giant hedge.
I know. And it was all treated grass. I think each blade had a name and was combed. But I elected not to continue the service, and I tried, Mike. I admit, you know, I'm a weed killer user from a few years back because I bought the 4 bags, the seasonal bags, to treat the lawn, and I lost the war. So I have got white clover and what I think is ground ivy. And, yeah, that's where I'm at, and I'm looking at, you know, how to treat them, and I think I'm going to just have to live with them. But I wanted to hear a little bit of what you have. Organifi me if you can.
There's no need. Grass is naturally regenerative. It is the chemical companies and the marketers and the landscapes that have convinced people, oh, it needs this, it needs that, it needs fungicides, it needs insecticides. Nonsense. In the UK, they don't treat their grass with anything. They don't even feed it. There's no grass section in the garden centers. I once asked a guy in a garden center, where's your lawn fertilizer? And he goes, fertilizer? Geez, then we'd have to cut it even more often. So the secret is that they kind of invented the grassy lawn where you have the house right behind it and you have a raised porch and you look out over the sea of green with your plantings on the side. And you got to have a cool season lawn. So the rules are, well, let me ask you first, what do you cut your lawn with?
Well, my husband, I'm not allowed to use it, but there's a riding John Deere, and it can either pick up the clippings if we've let it go too long, because I know about your 3, 3.5 inches. Do I go Cornwall and Devonshire and say this is an English lawn and not worry and stop using sprays and things like that?
Oh, please don't. No more sprays. The sprays are weakening your grass and making it difficult for it to compete with weeds. These plants would not have survived if they needed somebody to baby them. So you got to be a big girl. Put on your big girl pants. Now, the clover is incredibly valuable. It is a favorite pollinator plant. You'll get a lot of native bees and honeybees coming to your lawn. And when your husband does cut those heads off and leaves them on the soil, they are full of nitrogen, which is the perfect lawn food, which is why we leave the clippings on the lawn too. They are 10% nitrogen, which is exactly the food that lawns like. And, of course, it's like they're used to it. They know it. It's part of their own biomass. So there's a whole cycle there being repeated. the gill over the ground is an unusual plant. Like many others, it was introduced as an ornamental because, you know, the vine is very pretty, right?
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
And when you
but
mow it.
Not in my yard, not in my grass.
Okay. When you mow it, it smells like sage, but it does grow very low to the ground. So the only way, and by the way, the leaves are resistant to herbicides just physically. They're kind of waxy, and the herbicide can't stay on.
Mm.
Plus, again, everything you spray to kill something is going to negatively affect your lawn. Now, you say your husband has a John Deere riding mower.
Yes.
Do you know the last time he had the blade sharpened?
He does it just about every year.
Excellent. Now,
yeah, he's pretty careful.
Because it's a deer, he can get a conversion kit very inexpensively that blocks the side discharge and forces the grass to be held inside until it's cut and recut into dust-like particles. And the lawn immediately starts feeding on that. It's very inexpensive. He'll get a plug, and he'll get a new, sharper blade, which is formed to do the most mulching of grass. And the gill over the ground, the creeping Charlie. You can, in wet soil, just follow the vine until you reach the root system, and then maybe have somebody there with a hose or a watering can and really saturate the area where the root enters the ground until you can reach down, almost having your hand on the soil, and pull slowly. And that way, you'll get the root system, and you're done with that. You can divide the lawn into segments and say, I'm going to take care of the creeping Charlie over here this week, and then I'm going to move there. If you space it out, it's not as laborious seeming, and it is a really effective way to get rid of creeping Charlie. And I really urge your husband to get that conversion kit. Like I said, they're not really expensive. Deers are very high quality machines. And without any knowledge, I can almost guarantee they'll have the conversion kit for that lawnmower. And make sure he does mow high. And it almost sounds like a Three Stooges reference. Mow high! And if you really want to add some impact, you can have your lawn core aerated this fall. I presume it's nothing you've ever done.
No, I have not done that.
So riding mowers, they compact the soil. You know, you're driving a small truck.
Mm-hmm.
And compacted soil favors weeds, not grass. And the cure for that is every 5 or 6 years, I would recommend highly a professional coming out and pulling plugs out of the lawn with what's called a core aerator, C-O-R-E. It actually pulls plugs out of the soil so that the pressure is relieved and the ground is less dense after they're done. And you can either rake up the plugs and compost them, or you could just leave them on the grass to disintegrate back into the lawn. But that, and I would urge you to love the clover, but every time it gets cut, it also feeds the lawn. It's kind of a can't miss thing. And as somebody reminded me the other day, grass seeds included clover up until the 1960s. It was felt to be an essential part of a well-kept lawn.
Wow, well, that's what I'll tell people if they comment on my lawn.
Yeah, we've got people growing wild jungles where their lawn used to be. You sound like it's very subtle, and something I haven't said in, oh, so many years. Don't stand on your lawn, look down at it, and then go, oh my God, there's bare spots, there's weeds. Lawns are meant to be seen from 20 to 50 feet away. And when you do that, it's amazing how great they look. People driving by are going to think it's a perfect golf course lawn. So look at the big picture, too.
That sounds fabulous. I especially appreciate the Creeping Charlie because it is very satisfying on a rainy day to go pull one of those guys carefully up and get the whole vine.
Yeah.
So that gives me something to work on. And then I have two quick other things, unless you need to scat. I have a bare spot where the duck pen just left me. Very fertile ground, 16 by 8 foot, perfectly flat.
But it's bare and you want grass.
Well, I don't know if I want grass. Maybe I should do something good for the planet and put in some good oxygen, carbon, you know, transmitters.
There is nothing better for the planet than non-chemical grass. It sequesters carbon like mad, pumps large amounts of oxygen into the air, absorbs carbon dioxide. The only bad thing about lawns is the salesmen and the charlatans and the chemical companies that have convinced people that a good lawn comes out of a sprayer, and it does not. But otherwise, just figure out what you want. Go to a garden center, you know. Pick out a plant. Fall is a great time for planting, by the way. The plants are generally reduced in price at the garden centers, and fall is the perfect time to plant almost everything, not spring.
Well, that's encouraging. I have taken a page full of notes, so I really appreciate all of this wealth of knowledge.
Okay, we good?
We're good. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. You take care now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Every once in a while, we get a really interesting email or phone call from a listener who can't be available during our taping session. So we're getting in the habit now picking out the best of those calls and answering them after the fact without any interaction. So I'll do my best. And here comes one.
My name is Rose, and I live in the Ozarks here in Missouri. And a comment is about the wireless deer detractor. We're right in the middle of deer country here. And there is a law in Missouri that you cannot put a deer attractant anywhere on your property. It's also my deer. You have to go through all sorts of hideous things like tangling thorn-covered briars, barbed wire fences, and you name it. And I don't think that a poke in their nose would make that much difference to them. I don't know. I haven't tried it, but what I use is a animal stopper, and essentially it smells like dead meat. So I thought that might help. Love your show. Bye.
Well, I can understand the law because hunters will often try to lure deer to a specific area where they have a tree stand set up. And I believe that is illegal in many states. And, you know, for good reason. I mean, it's just unfair. You're not really hunting. You're like shooting metal ducks at a carnival or something. What you're referring to is called the wireless deer fence. And again, you look it up online, wireless deer fence. You get three stakes with electrodes on the top and scent pellets that you use to attract the deer to the electrodes on the top. They get a mild shock and run away. Now, I have to tell you, I mean, you're not piling up a huge amount of corn in a field and then picking them off. So I don't think the law was meant for this, but I think it's worthwhile. The animal repellent you mentioned is probably made from rotten eggs, essentially. And it is very effective at keeping deer and other herbivores away. But as you know, you have to reapply it after rains. It loses its effectiveness. So my solution is the motion-activated sprinkler. I mean, you have a long season there. You could have this thing hooked up for all the growing season before you get a freeze. And it's very simple. I mean, you'll find a lot of them online, motion-activated sprinkler. It senses, it has a motion activator in the head of this device. And then you can either have a short stake that puts it in the ground, or I went for a big tripod that holds it above everything because it's much more effective. And when the motion detector detects something as big as a deer, for God's sake, it shoots a couple of cups of cold water at them, and they run away. I use both. I have a motion-activated sprinkler to protect my garden, but I have hostas, beds of hostas, all throughout the rest of my property, and the last 2 years, the deer have eaten them before they can flower. So this year I went ballistic, took all of the wireless deer fence stakes I had, which was a dozen, made sure there were fresh batteries in them, made sure they had fresh attractor pellets, and surrounded the hostas, which is deer's favorite food, with them. And so far, I shouldn't be saying this, should I? I should wait until the flowers are done. But so far, the stalks of the hostas are untouched, and I see the purple flowers beginning to emerge. So you're welcome to keep using your repellent. There's no law against using the motion-activated sprinkler. Okay? Good luck to you. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and reveal that this is the perfect time to plant bulbs of saffron crocus. A little earlier in cool climes and a little later in warm ones. And then, surprise, they will bloom and produce those distinctive and valuable saffron threads late this fall. But don't go looking for planting stock just yet, because we'll be right back with everything you need to know about wineberries and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Have you been following our saga of a mysterious poison ivy prevention potion supposedly lost to the ages? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we will present the promised update on this mysterious cure, plus your mysterious phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, I'll tell you about a delicious and wonderful fruit that's probably growing all around you. And you can enjoy it if you just open your eyes. But before that, another of your fabulous phone calls. Number to call, 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Not 1, not 2, but 3. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I confused myself.
Hi, Mike. This is Joe from Cincinnati.
Oh, what a pleasure. What can we do you for?
I planted some seed potatoes in a raised bed 2 years ago. Maybe it was 3. And the above ground, they look great. All kinds of green foliage. No, there were no problems. But then when I, end of the season, when I dig up the ground underneath the foliage. I get very few, if any, potatoes. And now that they come back every year and they look great this year, this season, but I'm just curious, what can I do to produce more potatoes underground?
Now, wait a minute. You mean you're leaving the potatoes in the ground?
No, I did. I dug
That's
them
the
up,
only way they come back, few. Joe.
The only way they come back if what? If
it
I leave them?
Is if you leave the spuds in the ground. It may be so simple as you didn't expand the area you were looking, because they don't spontaneously appear. But for instance, after I harvest my potatoes, I try to make sure we got every single one, because I'm a fool for fresh potatoes. But the following year, we always get some, quote, volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you get the potatoes?
My daughter bought them at a store.
Yeah. I would recommend, if you want real success, start with certified disease-free potatoes. Supermarket potatoes are often sprayed with a sprouting inhibitor, and they don't produce well. You want to go to, I would recommend you go to the website of Wood Prairie Farm. They are the premier potato supplier, and they have some ridiculously cool varieties. So you've got volunteer potatoes coming up now.
Yes.
Okay. Do flowers appear at the top of your plants?
Not that I remember.
Yeah, they should. They've probably been heavily treated. But 3 weeks after flowers appear at the top of the plant, and they're beautiful flowers, they're like little orchids, you can start harvesting. Potatoes are ready to eat if you can see them. They're good at any size. So, you know, in my garden, I've started harvesting already, and I got a bunch of nice little red potatoes, and I got so many plants, I'll just, you know, pick one that I want to use the bed for something else, whatever, and harvest enough for a week every week until we're out of it. So start with certified disease-free potatoes. Do not cut them into pieces. Plant whole potatoes. Frankly, I think that'll be it. At the end of this season, do you have a garden fork?
Yes.
You do? Not a pitchfork, a smaller version with wider blades.
Oh, I know what you mean. I can get one.
Yeah, that is the best. What you do is you shove that thing all the way into the ground, as far away from the plant as you can manage, and start lifting up the soil. I have found potatoes growing in the bed next door underground.
Wow.
Yeah, so, no, they move around a lot. And if your raised bed is any good, that is if the soil is nice and you don't walk on it, they can spread rapidly, and which is a good thing.
So how far away from the main plant, roughly? Like a foot, 2 feet?
I never measured myself. Well, you can always start gently a foot away. And if you hear that you've nicked a potato, take it from 2 feet away. There's no disadvantage to a wide harvest area. And if you do nick any potatoes while you're harvesting them, they're still fine. What you want to do is wash them off right away and put them in jars of water in the fridge. The water prevents them from browning out or looking bad or anything like that. It's great.
So before I plant new seed potatoes or new potatoes, should I dig up the old plants I have now as much as possible?
Oh, yeah. You're going to dig those up at the end of the season. You're going to plant your new potatoes next spring.
Okay, got it. Maybe there's potatoes in there I just haven't gotten to because I didn't dig that far away.
The bigger the plant, the more likely there are potatoes. But, you know, it's up to you. You want to try.
Okay.
How many plants do you have?
Two.
Yeah, I would wait it out and get the biggest size you can this year. And then next year, maybe plan to have another raised bed around and really go to town with high-quality, disease-free potatoes.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate your help.
Well, good luck to you. I love potatoes. Don't wash the dirt off when you bring them in. Just put them somewhere in a dark, cool area and wash them right before you use them.
Potato connoisseur you are.
Oh, yeah. Come on. I'm Irish.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
All right, man. We got to go.
All right. Thanks for your help.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling the wonderful world of wineberries. On July 6th, our You Bet Your Garden Facebook page featured images of my beloved wineberries, both harvested and fully ripe, but still on the cane, which prompted Marlene Newmiller of Newmiller Farms in Three Oaks, Southwest Lower Michigan, to write, "I would like to know more about these. Could it be a show topic?" That's a great idea, Marlene. These treasures often go unappreciated, mainly because people don't know if they're edible or not. I found out that they are wonderfully edible by accident in 1992. It was our personal worst summer without a summer, and it decimated my plants. One of my tomato varieties, the excellent Siberian tomato, Black Crim, survived, but all the other plants drowned or died from rickets after getting almost zero sun until late July. My cultivated raspberries managed to survive, but produced no flowers or fruit on their second-year canes. Luckily, that year's new growth survived and did give us some fruit that fall. But my wife and kids were in tears, their first summer without homegrown raspberries. I had noticed clusters of bright red fruits on massive prickly canes growing near the road and in the woods, but had been told that their flavor was insipid and that the plants were invasive weeds. But hoping to please my family, I picked a few. Well, if that's what insipid tastes like, give me more. They are the juiciest berries I've ever tasted. The flavor is somewhat subtle, but absolutely delicious. I picked as many of the bright red fruits I could find until the birds and I had finished that year's crop. Ever since, my family is happy when the cultivated raspberries start coming in, but they jump for joy when I start bringing in the wineberries. In his excellent and highly recommended by me book, Wild Urban Plants of the Northeast, Harvard botanist Peter Del Tredici describes the wineberry, quote, as an Asian raspberry with arching stems that root at the tips, compound leaves with three leaflets each, which luckily don't resemble the three leaves of poison ivy in any way, and small white flowers. I note here that some sources call the plant Japanese raspberry, despite not having Japonica in its name. Peter, who I had the pleasure of interviewing on the show when his book first came out, provides the plant's scientific name. Now be kind, Rubus phenocoliaceus. I think that was pretty good. And writes that all of the plant's parts are densely covered with reddish glandular hairs that glisten in the sunlight. It really is highly ornamental. He judges the fruits to be, quote, delicious, adding that wineberry grows, quote, vigorously in moist, sunny sites, and that several states list it as invasive species. In New York State, it is illegal to own or sell. Well, poo on those disparaging states. The berries are wonderfully edible. The plant does no harm, and it provides food and shelter for wildlife, especially birds who will compete with you for every berry. Truly invasive plants are pestiferous and difficult to remove, like running bamboo, chameleon plant, and wisteria. If you don't want wineberry, it is ridiculously easy to remove. Just pull it out of the ground. Easy peasy. People who want you to destroy wonderful weeds like wineberry simply do not like plants in general and enjoy making lists of bad things, whether they be plants or people. Back to wineberries. One of the most striking features of the plant is that the fruits hide inside hairy pods that open up when the fruits begin to ripen. I took a great photo of this feature, and you'll find it at our Facebook post for July 6th. But don't pick them orange when they first appear. For full flavor, wait until the fruits turn bright red, which is also when the birds will start going after them. The berries keep surprisingly well in the fridge in the kind of perforated plastic containers you see holding strawberries in the supermarket. This, quote, fruit from a pod feature seems to be totally unique and great help in further identifying the plant. The fruits leave the highly ornamental base structures on the plant when you harvest, same as cultivated raspberries and thimbleberries, which I call black cap raspberries. This is unlike blackberries, which don't leave a core behind when you pick them. Your best bet to obtain them is to study what the young plants look like. They are very distinctive, and protect them. Once they're fully grown and fruiting, the birds will plant more for you nearby. You'll also find them in expected places like the margins of fields and sunny spots in the woods, and unexpected ones. I just saw a big cluster of the canes in an unkempt area between my bank and a McDonald's and made a note to come back with containers the following year. Oh, and there were lots of mature weedy growth mixed in with them, so I was pretty confident they hadn't been exposed to herbicides. Now, you may read otherwise, but I have found them impossible to transplant. Not difficult, impossible. I have tried to move them by carefully shoveling out large islands of dirt with tiny plants on them, and they did not take. They were growing in the lanes between my raised beds. Otherwise, I would have left them alone. I have even tried gently moving them during heavy rains. No dice. I tried for the years and then finally gave up. So learn to recognize them, protect baby plants that spring up on your property and in the wild, and pick them promptly, or the birds will do it for you. Well, that sure was some hopefully helpful information about wonderful wineberries now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page, where once again, you'll also find my photos of this year's wineberry crop on the page for July 6th. Yikes, my producer is threatening to dime me out to the New York Invasive Plant Authorities if I don't get out of this studio. Come and get me, coppers. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, extension number 3, or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Please, I don't know what I have to do. Put up a neon sign in Times Square. But please include your location. And visit our Facebook page, where we are always posting new photos of stuff that looks good in my garden. important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week, and links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when the Philadelphia Phillies folded and missed out on winning the National League pennant in 1964. They were 6.5 games up with only 12 games left in the season, and they lost 10 of them. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziproth. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I have finished harvesting this year's crop of glorious garlic and will be turning heads under the ceiling fan on my well-ventilated porch every day or so that they dry nice and evenly until I see you again next week.